Usually when we talk about diagnosing a problem, there's this expectation of like clinical precision. Like you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points at the screen and says, there's the fracture. It's binary, it's clean. But lately I've been looking at how we diagnose the problems of entire societies, these massive socio-ecological systems. And it feels like that x-ray machine is just, it's completely
Oh
useless.
yeah, it's a completely different scale of complexity. We are so used to isolating a single variable, fixing it, and moving on. But when you look at the state of the world right now, that isolated approach is, well, it's fracturing.
Exactly. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky. So, okay, let's unpack this. Today, we are going on a massive, ambitious, deep dive into how entire societies recover from layered, cascading crises. We're talking about what researchers call a polycrisis. This is where war, extreme inequality, ecological destabilization, institutional failures, they aren't just happening at the same time. They are actively crashing into each other and multiplying.
Which is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Right.
When crises interact like that, a localized band-aid just, it doesn't work. The standard tools we use to fix isolated economic or, environmental problems just aren't equipped for systemic compounding damage.
Yeah, and to help us navigate this, we are diving into two incredibly rich sources by the author Bechara Saheeli. We have a foundational conceptual article, and we have its companion research architecture. And I want to be really clear right out of the gate here. These are not white papers. They are rigorous, deeply thought-out frameworks designed to build a credible science of what Saheeli calls civilizational healing. So our mission today is to explore this life-grounded theory. We want to understand how societies can actually recognize, interrupt, repair, transform, and learn from systemic injuries, and crucially, without just taking the harm and exporting it somewhere else.
Right, and the terminology here is doing a lot of heavy lifting. It's really worth pausing on how the author defines those two core words, civilization and healing. Because often when people hear the word civilization, they instantly think of a ranking system.
Oh, like a hierarchy.
Exactly. We have this historical baggage of assuming some peoples are civilized and others are uncivilized. But in this foundational conceptual article, the author just completely strips away that hierarchy. Civilization simply denotes a historically extended socio-ecological order.
So it's not a value judgment at all. It's just a description of scale. Like, it's the infrastructures, the rules, the ecologies, the shared habits that organize collective life across multiple generations. It's basically the big picture of how we live together.
That's a great way to put it. And then we have healing. Now, in this context, healing is a functional analogy. It is strictly not a biological ontology.
Okay, wait, meaning what exactly?
Meaning, we are not treating society like a literal physical body with a single brain. And we certainly aren't treating political dissent or social friction as a disease to be cured. Healing here is about disciplined, collaborative reorganization.
Okay, but let me push back a little there. If society isn't a literal body, why rely on the word healing at all? I mean, we have perfectly good terms like problem solving or social reform or, I don't know, policy optimization. Why borrow from biology?
Well, because biological repair provides highly disciplined analogies that problem solving completely misses. Think about it. A math error is a problem to be solved. You fix the equation and it's done. But in a biological system, an injury can be systemic and cumulative. And more importantly, repair depends on both internal capacities and external conditions. Like if you have a severe physical wound, a doctor can't just mandate that it closes by tomorrow.
Yeah, they can't just legislate it away.
Exactly. They have to provide the right environment. Nutrition, cleanliness, rest, protection from further harm, so the tissue can regenerate itself.
Ah, I see where you're going. It's about the environment of recovery.
Precisely. By using the term healing, the framework forces us to ask, what are the environmental and institutional conditions required for a society to regenerate? It acknowledges that societal injuries are often intergenerational, and they get deeply embedded in the very rules of how our systems operate. Problem solving sounds like something you do to a machine.
Right.
Healing is what happens within a living system.
That tracks perfectly. So, to understand how a civilization learns to heal, we first have to understand the specific type of injury these sources are describing. Because reading through the foundational conceptual article, it becomes really clear that we aren't just talking about bad luck or a natural disaster. We are talking about a systemic pattern.
Yes, and this brings us to the core diagnostic meta pattern introduced in the text, which is called organized life disconnection.
Organized life disconnection.
Well, this is the systematic separation of decisions from their consequences, of benefits from burdens, and of knowledge from power.
So the system is structurally unplugging itself from the realities of living things.
It is. But we need to make a very clear caveat here. This organized life disconnection does not require deliberate malicious intent.
Oh, really?
Yes. It is a systematic institutional pattern that can persist and thrive, even without conscious intent, from the people operating inside it. You don't need a cartoon villain in a boardroom plotting to destroy a community. You just need rules, metrics, and incentives that reliably separate the people making decisions from the people or the ecosystems feeling the impacts of those decisions.
Let me offer a clear hypothetical illustration here to ground this, because I think we've all experienced a version of this in our daily lives.
Sure.
Imagine a large hospital system where the administrators are evaluated and financially rewarded entirely based on patient turnover speed. The core metric is just how fast can we process people in and out of beds?
Okay.
Meanwhile, the actual doctors on the floor are penalized. Maybe they get bad performance reviews for spending extra time diagnosing complex, unusual illnesses, because that slows down the daily turnover rate.
That is a classic structural trap.
Right. And in this hypothetical illustration, no one is trying to hurt the patients. The administrators aren't evil. They are just following the incentives they were given. The doctors certainly want to heal people. But the institution's disconnected design systematically produces terrible health outcomes for anyone with a complex disease. The metric itself becomes the ultimate goal rather than the patient's actual health.
That is a brilliant hypothetical of what the source is called the great inversion.
The great inversion.
Yeah. The great inversion happens when institutions become optimized purely for their own reproduction. They start chasing internal metrics, throughput, bureaucratic preservation, or political survival. When that happens, the original purpose of the institution is inverted. The means, like processing patients efficiently, become the ends. And living beings, human health, ecological systems, they become mere inputs. They become externalities, or worse, obstacles to the metric.
The machine feeds itself, and life just becomes the fuel.
Exactly. Now, to truly diagnose this pathology, we can't just look at it broadly. We have to break down how this disconnection actually operates on the ground. The foundational conceptual article outlines 6 specific mechanisms of injury.
Okay.
Rather than just listing them out, let's think about them in the context of a hypothetical town that relies on a single, massive, highly polluting industrial plant.
Okay, I'm picturing a town built around a massive chemical processing facility. The river is turning a weird color, people are getting sick, but the plant is the only major employer. Let's run it through the 6 mechanisms.
First, you have domination. This is the concentration of the ability to decide, while insulating those decision makers from the consequences. In our town, the executives making the production decisions live 1,000 miles away in a different state. They decide to cut safety protocols to save money, but they don't drink the local water.
They get the profit. The town gets the polluted river. That makes perfect sense.
Second is extraction and externalization. This mechanism converts living systems into resources and then shifts the cost of depletion somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The plant isn't paying for the health care of the workers getting sick, and they aren't paying to filter the toxic runoff out of the municipal water supply. They have externalized those costs onto the local taxpayers.
So they're basically getting a massive hidden subsidy by forcing the town to pay for the damage.
Exactly. Third is enclosure. This removes shared means of life, like land, water, or knowledge, from accountable common governance.
How would that look here?
Well, let's say the chemical plant buys up all the land around the river and heavily lobbies the local government to deregulate water testing. The community no longer has any democratic say over their own life support system.
The commons have been fenced off. Wow.
Fourth is narrative and epistemic capture. This narrows what can even be perceived or measured. The plant releases an annual report boasting about the jobs they've created and the local GDP growth, and the local politicians echo that narrative. The rising asthma rates and the dying fish aren't on the official spreadsheet. So according to the dominant narrative, they simply don't exist.
If you control the metrics, you control reality. And actually, that brings up the term epistemic. We see that a lot in these sources. For anyone unfamiliar, when we talk about epistemic capture, we essentially mean controlling whose knowledge is considered valid, right?
Yes. If a local mother says, "My kids are constantly sick since the plant expanded," Epistemic capture is the mechanism that dismisses her lived experience as anecdotal while treating the company's flawed internal safety report as hard data.
That's insidious. What's the fifth mechanism?
Trauma polarization. Unresolved injury transforms into a threat-based identity. Maybe the town starts fracturing. Some people want the plant closed to save their health, but others are terrified of losing their jobs and losing their homes.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the unresolved trauma of being exploited turns them against each other in retaliatory politics, while the distant executives remain completely insulated from the conflict.
The community fights itself instead of the source of the injury. That is so common. And the final mechanism.
Fragmentation and short-termism. Responsibility is divided into such small, localized units that preventing system-level failure becomes literally nobody's job.
Right.
The local water board only looks at pipes. The labor board only looks at wages. The environmental agency is underfunded and only looks at specific emissions. No single entity has the mandate or the perspective to say, this entire socio-ecological arrangement is killing us.
Wow. When you lay it out like that, you realize how incredibly resilient a dysfunctional system can be. All six of those mechanisms work together to protect the great inversion.
They do.
Now, alongside those mechanisms, the sources mention that we need to view these pathologies through five specific lenses.
Yes. To fully map the injury, we need to look through a direct lens, which is who is being harmed right now? A structural lens, what are the rules making this harm recurrent? A cultural lens, what narratives legitimize this harm? An ecological lens, what life support systems are degrading? And an epistemic lens, can the system actually learn from the people being harmed?
And reading through the framework, there's one more lens that cuts across all of those, the temporal lens.
The temporal lens is crucial. It tracks delayed effects and intergenerational transfers.
Oh, I see.
Because an economic policy might look highly successful through a direct lens today, but the temporal lens forces you to ask, are we just transferring an immense, unpayable ecological debt to our grandchildren?
Okay, so we've thoroughly mapped the pathology. We know what organized life disconnection looks like, but there are a lot of frameworks out there trying to fix the world. Sustainability, resilience, peace building, the capability approach. What is it that previous thinkers have missed that this civilizational healing framework is trying to capture?
Well, the author evaluates those adjacent traditions like salutogenesis, peace building, resilience, and so on, and describes them as indispensable but partial.
Indispensable but partial. That's a great phrase. Why are they partial? What's the blind spot?
Take the concept of resilience. In systems theory, resilience is generally seen as a positive trait. It's the ability of a system to absorb a shock and maintain its basic structure. But think about our hypothetical factory town.
Yeah.
The corporate domination over that town might be incredibly resilient to outside shocks. An unjust extractive hierarchy can be highly resilient.
Right. If the goal is just resilience, you might just be making a terrible system more durable.
Exactly. Or take the push for a green energy transition.
Mm.
If we transition to electric vehicles, but we still rely on extracting minerals through exploited labor and displacing indigenous communities,
yeah,
that is a transition, yes. But it is just reproducing the old logic of dispossession in a new green wrapper.
Wow, yeah.
The civilizational healing framework argues that without a common normative ground, these adjacent traditions can be co-opted to serve the great inversion.
So we need core constructs to anchor us to ensure we are actually moving toward health and not just a shinier version of extraction. The sources define two foundational pillars here.
Yeah.
Life capacity and life ground. Let's break those down.
A life capacity is what a society should enable. It is an effective, context-dependent ability to be and to do. For human beings, that means bodily health, practical agency, epistemic standing, meaning your voice actually counts, and relational trust.
Okay.
For ecosystems, a life capacity is functional integrity and regenerative potential.
So it's not just having a right on paper, it's having the actual material ability to live well.
Precisely. And that brings us to the life ground. The life ground is the foundation that makes those capacities possible. It is the set of biophysical and social conditions required for life capacities to exist. We're talking about clean air, breathable water, access to care, verifiable knowledge, and accountable institutions.
Okay, let me pause you there. Because whenever someone introduces a universal baseline like a life ground, I get a little skeptical.
Sure.
Does establishing a life ground mean we are forcing one universal set of cultural values onto everyone? Like, are we saying this is the enlightened way to live and every community must conform to this specific model?
Absolutely not. The framework is fiercely explicit about avoiding that trap. The framework requires plural pathways. Establishing a life ground just sets a necessary floor, not a ceiling, and certainly not a monolithic cultural blueprint.
Okay, I see.
Think of it this way. You cannot have a vibrant, pluralistic debate about the philosophical meaning of a good life if the room is filling with toxic smoke, or if half the people are starving.
Right. You can't exercise cultural autonomy if your water supply is poison.
Exactly. Justice, human rights, and ecological viability act as constitutive constraints. They are the boundaries that keep the space safe. People, communities, and nations can disagree deeply about spirituality, kinship, economics, and art. But those disagreements must take place on a shared foundation where basic life capacities are protected and not actively destroyed by the system itself.
That makes a lot of sense. The life ground secures the stage so the play can actually happen. So with that foundation set, we need to look at how a civilization actually moves from injury to recovery. And this is where the conceptual article makes a very sharp, very important distinction between a cure and healing. What is the mechanical difference there?
A cure is generally understood as an intervention that removes or reverses a specific disease process. Mm. For example, antibiotics cure an infection.
Yeah.
But a cure might leave a whole host of other issues completely untouched. It doesn't address the ongoing disability, the grief of the experience, the social exclusion, or the institutional causes that expose the person to the infection in the first place.
So curing the immediate symptom doesn't mean you've addressed the environment that created it?
Right. Healing addresses the broader context. Healing leaves space for addressing that grief, integrating the experience, and transforming those institutional causes so the recurrence conditions are fundamentally altered. And there is a critical distinction to make here. Healing is never about returning to a pristine prior state.
Because you can't unring the bell.
Precisely. Histories of domination, colonialism, and massive ecological changes make going backward impossible and, frankly, undesirable.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Healing includes emergent possibilities. It is about building a capacity for life-coherent self-correction moving forward, not hitting a rewind button to a past that was likely flawed anyway.
It's adaptation, not nostalgia. And to actually execute this, the framework outlines a grammar of healing consisting of 7 functions. But before we get into them, there is a major conceptual guardrail the author stresses, right?
Yes. These are 7 recursive healing functions, not 7 sequential steps.
Recursive, not sequential.
They are designed to discipline our attention to ensure we don't skip vital parts of the process, but they absolutely do not imply a fixed sequence. You know, just check them off 1 through 7 and declare victory. Learning, for instance, can and must revise every earlier function.
Okay, let's walk through them, maybe keeping our hypothetical toxic factory town in mind. How does a society start?
The first function is recognition. This is the act of making injury politically consequential. It's moving an issue from invisible, private suffering into the public sphere. It requires genuinely listening to the testimony of affected people and looking at the distribution of harm, not just community averages.
Mm-hmm. Right, because if the town's average income is high, the spreadsheet looks fine, even if the neighborhood right next to the chemical plant is experiencing extreme illness. If you don't recognize the specific harm, you can't begin. What follows recognition?
Diagnosis. This goes deeper than recognition. Diagnosis is mapping the exposure, uncovering the systemic mechanisms, tracing the history, and identifying the margins of vulnerability. It asks the hard questions about what remains unhealed, even after a competent immediate response.
So we recognize the river is toxic, and we diagnose that it's because of the distant executives utilizing extraction and enclosure. What's next?
Protection. This is the imperative to interrupt ongoing harm. Protection could be a legal injunction against a polluting factory, a ceasefire in a conflict zone, or providing immediate emergency income support to exploited workers.
This makes perfect logical sense. You can't start repairing a wound if the knife is still actively cutting. You have to stop the bleeding first.
Exactly. Which brings us to the fourth function, which is repair. Repair is the active work of restoring the capacities, rights, and relationships that can and should be recovered. Crucially, this requires material restitution and ecological remediation, not just symbolic apologies.
But if we just clean the river, the factory executives could just pollute it again next year, which is why repair alone isn't enough.
That is exactly why the fifth function is transformation. Transformation is changing the underlying rules, the infrastructures, and the power relations that generated the injury in the first place. If you don't change the rules, you are just treating symptoms. This often includes de-implementation actively dismantling practices that are institutionally familiar but actively harmful.
We have to restructure the town's economy so they aren't held hostage by a single extractive employer.
Yes. And as we transform the system, we engage in the sixth function, regeneration. Regeneration is about creating self-renewing conditions where life can flourish. And again, this includes emergent new possibilities, not just restoring an old baseline. It is about enlarging the viable, healthy options for future generations.
And finally, the seventh function, which makes the entire framework a living loop.
Learning. This function closes the loop. It means rigorously comparing your actual outcomes with your original claims, tracking unintended consequences, and actively revising your actions based on new data.
And as we said at the start, these are recursive functions. If the town attempts a transformation, but the new economic plan accidentally prices low-income residents out of their homes, the learning function catches that. It forces the town to go back to recognition and diagnosis to address the new injury.
Precisely. If an institution refuses to change despite overwhelming evidence of failure, the learning function is broken. If you jump to transformation without recognition and justice, you might just reorganize domination. If you take action without learning, you just reproduce your errors.
So we have this incredible map for healing. But let's ground this in reality. Because a lot of policies look fantastic on paper, but when a crisis actually hits, they fail the people who need them most. How do we measure a society's actual resilience to these shocks?
This is where the framework demands we look at protective margins. Injury isn't just determined by the raw force of a shock. It is heavily mediated by the protective margins a community possesses.
What exactly does a protective margin look like in the real world?
It's essentially a buffer. It could be institutional slack, like having extra hospital beds before a pandemic hits. It could be ecological biodiversity, income security, or deep relational trust within a neighborhood.
I see.
Two communities can face the exact same climate shock, say a massive flood. But if one community has been historically deprived, redlined, and disinvested, its protective margins are thinned out to nothing. For them, the flood is catastrophic. For the wealthy neighborhood with strong margins, it's an extensive inconvenience.
It's like having a savings account for systemic shocks. If you live paycheck to paycheck, one flat tire ruins your month. Societies have to deliberately scale these margins so vulnerable communities have reserves.
Yes. And this brings us to one of the most rigorous, unyielding constraints in the entire framework. How do we prevent fake healing? How do we know a society didn't just solve its own problem by pushing the burden onto someone else?
Right. It's like trying to fix a leak in your roof by tilting your gutters so the water floods your neighbor's basement. Your house is dry, but you haven't solved the storm. You've just weaponized it.
That is a perfect analogy. The framework calls this the principle of non-displacement.
Okay.
The rule is simple but profound. If an apparent gain relies on exporting severe avoidable burdens to other groups, to other places, to different organizational scales, to other species, or to future generations, it counts against the claim of healing.
So let me throw out another hypothetical illustration. Let's say a wealthy, developed city decides it wants to be totally green. They ban all polluting vehicles and shut down their local power plants to improve their local air quality. But to get all the new batteries and solar panels they need, they just shift all the toxic manufacturing and mineral extraction to a poor neighboring country with zero labor laws.
In the eyes of this framework, they have not achieved civilizational healing. They have externalized a severe avoidable burden. That exported harm explicitly counts against a claim of healing.
Because they just reorganized their domination.
Exactly. Now, we must add a caveat that the text points out. There is always a distinct possibility that displaced harm might eventually come back to destabilize the originating system. We see this in geopolitics and ecology all the time. But a framework is careful to state this as a possibility, not an inevitable guarantee.
Right, because sadly, powerful groups can sometimes export harm for a very long time without it immediately crashing back down on them.
Correct. But whether the harm comes back to bite them or not, exporting severe harm fundamentally violates the life ground constraints. It fails the test of justice.
Okay, so if we aren't allowed to displace harm, and we have to fix these systems using these recursive healing functions, it implies that someone actually has the power to do the fixing. But historically, the people being harmed have no power, and the people in power have no incentive. How does Save Healy propose we bridge that gap? Who is actually in charge of the repair?
That brings us directly into the governance of these systems. In the conceptual article, there is a fundamental rule regarding governance called ARO alignment.
ARO alignment. Let's break that down.
ARO stands for Authority Resource Obligation Alignment.
Got it.
The rule states that an actor should only carry an obligation if they simultaneously hold the legitimate authority and the necessary resources needed to actually act on it.
Oh, this is the bane of every middle manager and frontline worker's existence. It is so common for someone to be given the obligation to fix a massive problem, but they have zero authority to change the structural rules and zero budget to get it done.
Yes. That is a classic ARO mismatch. An unfunded mandate is not distributed governance, it is responsibility dumping. If a federal government mandates that a marginalized local community must heal its own ecological damage, but the government doesn't give them the legal authority to sue corporate polluters or the financial resources to actually remediate the soil, that is an ARO failure. It guarantees the healing will fail.
So knowing that ARO alignment is critical, how does the companion research architecture propose we actually govern a massive research program testing these theories?
The research architecture outlines a governance design that is explicitly shared and polycentric. It involves affected community authority at its core, but it is very careful not to imply that communities alone govern the entire program.
Because that would be an ARO mismatch. You can't put the administrative and fiduciary burden of a massive international research program solely on the shoulders of a community that is already dealing with a crisis.
Precisely. It requires a coordinated web of governance bodies. There is a program council that holds fiduciary and strategic responsibility. There are community research assemblies that co-govern site priorities and help interpret the findings locally. There is indigenous governance holding authority where applicable. And there are independent boards for scientific and methods governance, as well as ethics and safeguards. They all work in coordination.
I'm trying to picture this in practice. In any polycentric system where power is distributed across multiple nodes like that, you are inevitably going to have friction. What happens when people just fundamentally disagree? What if a community flat out refuses to participate in a proposed research or repair pathway?
This is one of the most fascinating aspects of the architecture. In a traditional top-down project, a community's refusal is seen as a barrier, an annoyance, or a failure of the community to understand the science. But in this framework, refusal is treated as vital diagnostic data.
Wait, let me make sure I understand. Refusal isn't a failure.
No. Refusal by a community is treated as diagnostic evidence of an institutional failure or a lack of safety. Forced reconciliation is anti-healing. If a community refuses to participate, the governance system has to step back and ask, why is this unsafe for them? Where is the ARO alignment failing? What history of harm haven't we recognized?
That is a massive paradigm shift. It treats a no as a signal that the environment isn't right for healing yet. So all of this theory is incredibly compelling. But a theory is just words on a page until it hits the real world. How do we prove this actually works?
This is exactly why the foundational conceptual article is paired with the companion research architecture. The architecture is designed to test the theory empirically in the real world. And the most non-negotiable design commitment here is falsifiability, corrigibility.
Meaning the theory is built to be proven wrong if it doesn't hold up.
Exactly. If a theory is just a warm, fuzzy philosophy that can creatively explain away every single failure, it isn't scientifically useful. Falsifiability is a non-negotiable commitment.
So how do they actually test it?
Through 8 empirical propositions. These are highly specific, testable hypotheses. Let's look at a few of them. The first is life ground alignment. The proposition states that institutions that actively protect life capacities and ecological foundations will actually show greater adaptive capacity under shocks than institutions that externalize those costs.
And because it's falsifiable, they actively invite rival explanations for that, right?
Like mm-hmm.
A critic might say, hey, that green institution didn't survive the shock because it was aligned with the life ground. It survived because it had a massive endowment and a ton of money.
Exactly. The architecture explicitly demands that researchers test those rival explanations based on wealth or coercive capacity. They have to prove that the life ground alignment is actually the causal factor. Another crucial proposition is ARO alignment, which we just explored. The hypothesis is that repair actions that have a named duty holder, adequate resources, and a deadline will reach completion more often than diffuse, generalized commitments.
It sounds like common sense, but holding institutions strictly accountable to measuring that is rare.
We also have the protection repair complementarity proposition. This tests the idea that material repair, without interrupting the ongoing harm, will just yield transient gains. You can't fix the wound if the knife is still in it. There is the justice reconciliation complementarity proposition. And of course, the non-displacement proposition, which hypothesizes that apparent improvements at export burdens will show delayed fragility.
And there are propositions on polycentric coordination, cultural material coupling, and the role of protective margins. All eight of these propositions are designed to be tested, measured, and potentially falsified. But how is the actual research organized day to day?
The architecture executes this research through six linked, overlapping modular work packages.
And I want to highlight a really important structural point here. These are explicitly six linked, overlapping modular work packages. They are not sequential phases. Why is that modularity so vital to the research?
Because reality doesn't happen in neat, sequential phases. You can't tell a community experiencing a crisis to pause their lives until phase one is done. The packages are modular, so they can inform each other in real time. Work package one handles foundations and construct validation. Work package two builds a comparative healing atlas of historical and contemporary episodes. Work package three handles measurement and building an observatory.
Then we have work package four.
Yes, mechanisms, power, and cross-scale pathways. This is where they test how different institutional arrangements actually shape outcomes. Work package five is participatory healing laboratories, which involves co-designing bounded interventions in real-world institutions.
And then there is work package six. I want to clarify something here, because when people see work package six at the end of a big structural list, they often assume it's just the administrative hub, like the people managing the contracts and keeping the lights on. Is that what WP6 does?
It is incredibly important to correct that common misconception. Work package six is strictly dedicated to synthesis, governance support, translation, and cross-program learning. Its job is to integrate the findings from all the other packages and maintain the ethical quality of the research.
So they're doing the high-level intellectual and ethical synthesis. Who handles the day-to-day administration then?
The general coordination and program management functions, the logistics, the contracts, keeping the lights on, are performed by a separate entity called the Program Office. WP6 and the Program Office are distinct entities with very different ARO alignments.
That makes sense. Now, within this massive research architecture, collecting and sharing data is obviously a huge component. And in modern scientific research, the default expectation is usually open science. Publish everything, share all the data sets, make everything globally transparent. How does this framework handle data, especially when working with vulnerable or historically exploited communities?
The architecture is unambiguous on this front. Where indigenous research governance is discussed, indigenous authority, sovereignty, confidentiality, sacred knowledge, and legitimate restrictions absolutely override generic data sharing principles.
Because historically, transparency has often been used as a tool for extraction. Outside researchers come in, take the data, publish it for their own career advancement, and the community loses control of their own knowledge.
Exactly. You cannot use the banner of open science as a loophole to bypass indigenous sovereignty or extract sensitive knowledge without consent. However, we must caveat this carefully. The author does not broaden this specific protection into a blanket claim that open science as a whole is subordinate in every single circumstance outside of these specific contexts. Open science remains a highly valuable tool for global collaboration, but it cannot be weaponized to violate sovereignty.
It's about context and power dynamics, which honestly feels like the perfect summary of this entire framework. Okay, let's take a breath and recap the massive journey we've just been on. We started by diagnosing the systemic pathology of organized life disconnection. We looked at the great inversion, where institutions serve their own metrics instead of life, persisting even without deliberate malicious intent.
We did.
Then we established the foundation, life-grounded capacities, the necessary biophysical and social conditions required for any pluralistic society to flourish, acting as constitutive constraints, not cultural mandates.
And we saw how adjacent traditions are indispensable, but partial without that grounding.
From there, we looked at how societies respond using seven recursive healing functions: recognition, diagnosis, protection, repair, transformation, regeneration, and learning. And we firmly established these are a recursive loop, not a sequential checklist.
With the learning function constantly revising the others.
We talked about the strict constraints that prevent fake healing, ensuring ARO alignment, so obligations match authority and resources, and the absolute rule of non-displacement. If you export severe avoidable burdens somewhere else, it counts against your claim of healing.
And finally, we saw how all of this is tested through a rigorous research architecture using six linked, overlapping modular work packages to test eight falsifiable empirical propositions.
It is an incredible, comprehensive framework by Bechara Saheli. It challenges us to look past surface-level cures that leave institutional causes untouched and asks what it actually takes to transform the recurring generators of harm.
It demands that we look at the socio-ecological order as a whole, acknowledging our deep interdependence while refusing to erase the stark realities of power and vulnerability.
Exactly. And as we wrap up this deep dive into the source material, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought. And to be completely clear, I am explicitly introducing this as a question raised by the framework, rather than a definitive conclusion directly stated in the papers. This framework forces us to ask a really uncomfortable question about our own daily life and the organizations we operate within. As our own local institutions become increasingly efficient at hitting their internal metrics, whether that's quarterly profitability, patient turnover speed, or municipal efficiency, are we unknowingly stripping away the protective margins of the people and ecosystems right next door? And if we realize that we are, who among us currently has the ARO, alignment, the real authority, the resources, and the obligation to actually pull the emergency brake?